When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Hello?
Ngā mihi nui and welcome to Our Changing World. Ko Alison Balance tēnei. On tonight's show, we're catching up with Niwa's Andrew Laurie. Andrew is an expert in past and present climates, and he is always on the lookout for things that hold records of past climates. A few weeks ago, we had him on the show talking about handwritten weather records from last century. This week, the time-travelling climate scientist is taking us further back in time, and when I meet him in the lab in Auckland, he has a white slab on the bench.
We're looking at a fossil stony Parietes lutea coral. So these are stony corals, and this is from the island of Aitutaki in the Southern Cook Islands. It was collected in 2013 as part of a Marsden, and we're using the chemistry in the corals to reconstruct marine climate.
Wow, now we should describe it for the listeners, because sure. It doesn't look like a coral. If you're picturing something with many branches and lots of colour, this is not it.
No.
So it's a creamy white?
Yeah, it looks like a long, long fat ruler. And rather than having a branched coral, stony corals look like a cauliflower, a gigantic cauliflower, that's a good way to put it. And so what we do is we drill cores out of these stony corals.
These are dead stony corals?
These are dead ones, yeah. So they were cast up on the beach by some sort of event, whether it was a tsunami or a big storm. They were no longer alive. They're just sitting there on the shoreline. And we drill into them, and you can actually cut them in half, and you can x-ray them, and they've got rings like trees.
Really?
Yes,
can I see that with the naked eye?
You can't quite see it all the time with the naked eye. I could put it under the UV light in the other room, though, and you might be able to look at it.
What does the UV light show that this ordinary light doesn't?
Well, calcite sort of has this iridescent color under UV. What we don't want is calcite. The primary skeletal material of these corals are aragonite. And so if we see calcite, it means that it's been altered by probably rainwater and also high temperatures after it died sometime, and it would be completely buggered for paleoclimate reconstruction. So it's a check for us. It's a first order check. And the other thing is that we can see the banding, so we can have an idea about where we'd like to sample this. We use X-rays, so X-radiographs, to show where the banding is and how it might change directions, and it lets us sample these corals quite consistently at the top of a growth crest in the coral. And that's why these little, I guess, furrows that you see in the ruler in front of me, that's where a micromill, a precision-guided dental drill that has three axes. We've made this, and it tells us precisely where we are on this coral and with respect to those annual bands that we can see in the X-ray.
This is how long?
I'm guessing that's about 75 centimeters long.
And how many years does it cover?
Might have about 75 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's on average they're growing about a centimeter a year. And so that's really cool because, for one, there isn't a lot of high-resolution paleoclimate data from that part of the Pacific. The second thing is that it's pretty close to the core operation region of El Niño Southern Oscillation. And the third thing is that the medieval climate anomaly, which is what this coral dates from, we don't have a lot of information about paleoclimate and also ENSO for that time period. And there's a couple of thoughts about, okay, well, what's ENSO going to do in a changing climate as the world gets warmer? And so this might be a past analog for what our future might hold with ENSO.
So tell me about the medieval
anomaly? Medieval climate anomaly.
Is that when people went skating on the Thames?
No, that would be the Little Ice Age.
That's the Little Ice Age. Yeah, oh, okay, carry on.
That's the sequel to the medieval climate anomaly. And so temperatures, for instance, in places in Europe were warm, you know, very warm. You know,
oh, I got it completely wrong. So it's warmer than average.
Yeah, warmer than average. So, you know, growing grapes, for instance, in, you know, in England, which they're doing now, but they weren't for a long time. So we're studying this particular interval because it's a very interesting time in Earth's history, in recent history. There's also some social activity at that time. I mean, there's all sorts of really interesting historical activity going on in Europe. And we want to know a little bit more, obviously, about the climate. And, of course, in the South Pacific, an amazing time in the South Pacific when you consider the diaspora of humans across the Southwest Pacific and what was going on at this time, the push into East Polynesia from Samoa into this part of the world in the Southern Cook Islands, and then outward and onward, and then of course we got to New Zealand. So the question was, what was the climate like at this time? How variable was it? And how did the people interact with the climate conditions that occurred at this time?
So what is it that you get from this core, and what does it tell you about climate?
Sure, this core can tell us many things. So the first thing that we look at when we do the chemistry are the stable isotopes of oxygen and carbon. And the oxygen isotopes convolves a signal of the temperature of seawater and also the salinity of the seawater. Now, in parallel, what we can do is we can also analyze the trace element geochemistry and the strontium and the calcium ratio in this coral is more directly related to what's happening with temperature. So we can quantify temperature using strontium calcium, and therefore we can also weed out the effects of temperature on the delta O18 signal in the chemistry, and we can get to basically salinity, which in this environment we think is driven by rainfall, and that rainfall comes from the South Pacific Convergence Zone, which is a really fascinating and interesting atmospheric feature. It's, of course, the primary driver of rainfall for South Pacific Islands. It's really important for subsistence economies, and it's also the birthplace and incubation region for tropical cyclones for the region.
So, as things get warmer in the Pacific, what's going to happen? We're going to get more rain?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it is, in some parts, an open-ended question, because there's this interplay between, with warming, what happens to the atmosphere in the tropics and the circulation and what it does to, for instance, pushing the South Pacific Convergence Zone in one direction or another relative to where it sits on average now. With the El Nino Southern Oscillation, during El Nino years, it shifts to the northeast, and during La Nina years, much like kind of what we're expecting in this coming, you know, spring and summer, it shifts to the southwest. And there's a whole bunch of ramifications that come with that in terms of the relative risks for any island in the region that gets rainfall or tropical cyclones. So typically when we have La Nina years, we see the risk of tropical cyclones increase to the west of the international dateline. So islands like New Caledonia, Vanuatu, Fiji, Tonga, Niue, and also New Zealand, we see slightly elevated risk during those years of an interaction. Really neat, because we can then look into the past and say, okay, during a time when it was warmer than, say, the mid-20th century, what was the climate like? And do the patterns for this particular site, does it tell us anything about what ENTSO was doing and what the SPCZ was doing? There's this very strong interplay between the South Pacific Convergence Zone, SPCZ, and what's going on then, so because there's, of course, there's changes in the strength of the trade winds, and that helps to determine the relative position of the South Pacific Convergence Zone.
So are you seeing elevated temperatures on these cores?
It's hard to say. We're still working on something called a transfer function, which is a very hard thing to develop, where we basically look at modern observations from modern corals that are calendrically dated, and we compare it to our marine climate records. And by doing those types of correlations, we're able to derive an equation that takes the strontium-calcium ratio in the modern, and then we apply that to what we see in the past.
So you're not quite there yet?
We're not quite there yet, but we've got some other really interesting things up our sleeve in terms of looking at the variation of the oxygen isotopes through this 75-year record, and we can compare that to the variations that we see in modern corals. And we can make some sort of, I wouldn't say arm-wavy comments, but some assertions about how variable the climate was from year to year. And largely speaking, the main driver of that interannual variability is ENSO.
So was it more variable then?
It looks to be like it was equivalent to present. You know, like, so our first guess at some of these corals, looking at some of their patterns, is like that those times didn't look too different from what we're experiencing today, you know, in the 20th century. So that unto itself is really fascinating. The other thing is that this is a stage setter for the Southern Cook Islands and Polynesians moving into the Southern Cook Islands in the early part of the second millennium AD. And so Aitutaki is a really important area. My colleague Melinda Allen, she is the one who was leading this Marsden project on tying together human histories with climate histories. And there were all sorts of dynamical happenings between sea level changes and climate variability and then peoples coming into the region and using these islands and using the resources.
These corals obviously don't directly tell you about wind, but by telling you about the other things, you can sort of get a sense of what the winds were doing?
Well, that's really interesting. They may actually tell us about wind.
How would they do that?
Well, some of the signatures of the chemistry in them may be related to upwelling at the site. So if we have, for instance, enhanced upwelling in this easterly exposed location, it may tell us something about enhanced easterlies, whereas in another situation, it might not have those signatures. So that's a really interesting thing that paleoclimatologists are really just starting to probe with corals, is how can it be used as a wind proxy? Because, you know, the air and the airflow over the islands and the ocean is everything, really.
That amazes me. Everything else makes sense to me, but that wind?
Yeah, so this is pretty cool, and we've got it out right now because we're about to embark on some additional dating on it, and you can see that there are these little holes that are the size of, like, a large aspirin that are drilled out of the plinths. So we've got two plinths that are on the table here, one which we've milled. This one will remain in the archive for all time, and we don't want to destroy it.
Your caterpillar trench.
Apart from the caterpillar trench that's dug shallowly in it, the one next to it is an offcut. And so we match up the offcut, and we take and pop a sample out, and we date it. Now, we've done two dates on this one. This hole right here is a radiocarbon date. And this little chunk right next to that radiocarbon date, it says TIMS. And that's a technique that's used to measure uranium and thorium ratios. And the TIMS ages on the corals are much more accurate than radiocarbon during this time period. And so we can get the chronological date, down to an order of plus or minus like 4 or 5 years.
Oh, that's pretty precise.
Pretty precise at this.
Okay, so how old is that hole?
That hole is about 1,000 years old. Yeah, it's basically sitting somewhere in the 11th century.
Wow.
That may have been growing when William the Conqueror was doing his thing.
So how many of these samples have you got?
This mission that we had to Aitutaki, we had 101 unique corals that we sampled. Some of them had only one core drilled in them, and some had multiple cores drilled in them. So I think we've got somewhere on the order of 125 individual coral samples that are anywhere on the order from like a plug that's about 10 centimeters long for dating, and some of them are cores that are 1.6 meters long, like this one, or radial strips that were taken off of what we would call microatolls. So they almost look like a big portobello mushroom. So they come up into the shallow lagoon and then they start growing outwards. And so you can take a radial strip across those.
Could you collect similar samples from other island groups across the Pacific?
100%. I'm really the new kid on the block when it comes to coral paleoclimatology in the Pacific. There are a lot of other practitioners in the Southwest Pacific, and there's a focal point at Christmas Island in Kiribati because it's right in the middle of the core operating region of ENSO, right on the equator. And so people pick a couple of islands, and they work things out, and they do their bit for the larger puzzle.
Right, so you've just got one piece in a bigger puzzle.
Yeah, I've got one piece in a bigger puzzle, but I'd like to think that in terms of that piece, we've got a really amazing archive, and we've dated more than half of those samples that we brought back from the Cook Islands, and the spread of the dates march back in time. We haven't got much stuff during the period that we were actually targeting for the Marsden. We wanted stuff between about 1200 AD and 1800, and we got one that's probably sometime in, you know, the 17th, 18th century, another one in the 18th, 19th century, and some modern ones. Great for calibration, but during the period of occupation pre-European, it's almost like we've got nothing. And
but you've got older stuff.
But we've got older stuff, which is really interesting. So going from these samples, which are about 1,000 years old, it looks like we could get something continuous stitched together going back in time, you know, 2,000 years. So to about 3,000 years ago. And that unto itself is really interesting, and it makes a lot of sense as well in terms of what we know about the history of sea level in and around the Cook Islands, too.
And what is that history, that it goes up and down quite a lot?
Well, it was coming down. So basically, prior to Polynesian occupation of the main island and the motus that are surrounding the Aitutaki Lagoon, sea level was higher. And it wasn't until it dropped sufficiently to a level where, you know, the highest high tide allowed access to some of these smaller islets that you see, like, Polynesians occupying them and, you know, semi-permanently using them and the resources around them. So the sea level history of the Southwest Pacific as well, these corals are a very big contributor to. In this particular case, it has to do with more the long-term changes in polar ice and flexure of Earth's crust and the rebound of Earth's crust.
So it's the polar regions.
Yeah, believe it or not, there's a really interesting dynamic that happens over a long time period when you change the amount of ice at the pole. And when you load the crust, what happens, you know, is it flexes in another region. So you push down in one place, it goes up in another place. Some of the fossil corals that this one is like a cauliflower head that's been chucked up on shore, and we drill into it. But others are these microatolls. They look like those gigantic portobello mushrooms that have grown out. It almost looks like a wagon wheel on its side. And those are in situ, and those are amazing past sea level indicators, especially in a place like Aitutaki, where we think it's been tectonically stable. So we know the range that those corals, of tides that those corals live in, and so you can get a very precise estimate if you measure that coral, that fossil coral, and then you relate it to today's sea level datum. You can tell something about past sea level, and especially
right, so
it's not,
it's not the substrate that's gone up and down. It really is only it's the water.
It's only the water, yeah, only the water. But at any rate, like the simple take-home message is that corals that are in situ, that are fossil, which we can date accurately, they can tell us, they're almost like a datum of where certain parts of the lagoon used to be in the past. And so those datums are really important because they allow us to reconstruct a local sea level history. And then when you start putting that story together with other people's sea level history, you can get an idea about the dynamics of how the Earth's crust responds in these remote regions, very, very far away from ice sheets, which are changing and can, you know, really driving global sea levels.
Now, I'm curious, I've interviewed you in the past on Our Changing World to do with trees and wood and tree rings having climate records. Can you calibrate, use this new coral stuff with any of your tree information from New Zealand?
Yeah. This one in particular I had out because I thought I had a cunning plan to link this to trees. And my cunning plan was not through the rings, but it was going to be through the radiocarbon. And there's been a number of studies that have shown signatures in radiocarbon from Miyake events. So these are, Miyake events are coronal mass ejections from the sun. And they bombard the atmosphere and they change the production of radiocarbon in the upper atmosphere. And it leaves a signature in the tree rings. And so there's been some famous ones that have been studied, the 775 AD Miyake event, the 993-94 Miyake event, and this coral right here, I thought, oh yeah, we've got a, you know, date.
It's right in the
right the right time, 993. And so basically there's another study that shows that in some cases corals can be situated in a shallow enough environment where they have a, you know, they have a detectable response for the radiocarbon and you can get these Miyake events. So I was gonna, you know, try to link this up with the Kauri.
I feel a butt coming on.
But it doesn't look like it extends far enough forward in time, or back in time, rather, to capture that that Miyake event. If you think about how miraculous it is for tree ring dating, I mean, tree rings from different species vary in different ways according to whatever climatic sensitivity they have. All these tree ring practitioners were doing their measuring, building their chronologies independently, and they've done radiocarbon dating. And then when they do the sequential high-resolution radiocarbon dates across what they think is year 989, 990, 991, 992, 993, across the Miyake event and forward in time, they all get this coherent signature.
But you don't think this one can be plugged into it?
I don't think right now this can be plugged in, but it gives me hope that someday we would be able to align all of the archives. I mean, it ties into what we're doing for our current Marsden, which is, you know, Kauri tree rings, swamp Kauri, and high-resolution radiocarbon dating, and then taking that particular aspect of Kauri, which is used for calibrating lots of different evidence, and we're matching this up, we're synchronizing it with ice cores, because basically the beryllium-10 production in the atmosphere is driven by the same process that's driving the radiocarbon. Beryllium-10 in the ice cores shows the same fingerprint through time. So very common for us to find 800, 1,000-year, 1,500-year-old ancient Kauri from Northland. And so if we do these analyses in blocks of 20 or blocks of 40, depending on how far back we are, we get a structure of radiocarbon curve that's better than anything that's out there right now. Because the data that are out there right now that are modeled that people use to calibrate their radiocarbon dates are from things like caves, things like lakes. But with the trees, we've got true annual resolution in there. And we're able to put our hand on our heart and say, yes, we've got a sequence of 60 dates that, you know, 20-year blocks going down this chronology that's 1,500 years long. And so that's really valuable because that means that anything that's then calibrated via radiocarbon, which has utilized the Kauri that we're developing, okay, it can have an associated ice core age. So people can start lining up their evidence anywhere in the world, start really teasing apart this story about the interplay of humans and environments and how they're acting in their environments when things like climate variability comes along, extreme climate changes. And we want to know about this. It's an important thing for us to try to tease out because there was some absolutely crazy climate oscillations leading up to the height of the last ice age, the global last glacial maximum, which started about 27,000 years ago. And in the lead up to that, we had these wild swings in temperature, particularly in the northern hemisphere, these Danskoroshka events that we see in the ice cores. And yet at the end of the last ice age, we're the only species of human that came out of that intact. So it really begs the question about what role did those sorts of episodes play and what can we learn from them in terms of our future? What future do we face in terms of abrupt climate change, tipping points in the climate? How are we going to respond to it? So that's one of the main impetus for us doing these long sequences of Kauri, really fleshing out the global radiocarbon calibration curve. And there's no other place that has got wood that's as old and as good as what we've got here in New Zealand.
What period does your Kauri chronology span?
Sure. Well, we've got floating chronologies. We've got replication of wood from about 28,000, 27,000 years ago, all the way back to the limit and beyond of radiocarbon dating. So,
and the limit is?
Well, I mean, Alan Hogg is pushing out. He's pushed out a few good ones that are somewhere in the order of 60,000, 62,000 radiocarbon. We have large amounts of wood, and he gets very precise dates.
So you say our record from Kauri, there's nothing else like it in the world. Why is it so good? Is it because Kauri is just a really durable wood? What are the reasons why we've got such a long, good climate record?
Well, it's we're developing the climate record. We've got the resource. It's probably going to take us a career to develop a climate record from it. But it's like a string of beads. The dates on the wood that we've got out of the ground and in the archive, it looks like a string of beads spanning about 28,000 to 55,000 years ago. Why it's unique is that during the same time periods in the northern hemisphere temperate regions where you'd have trees that are growing that are good for dendro and that could have provided dendrochronologies, you also had ice covering the landscape and going across the peat bogs that used to be there and scraping that stuff away.
We've had ice, though, as well.
Not in Northland. Northland was unglaciated. So in terms of the North Island, glaciation was restricted to the higher central regions of the volcanic plateau.
So the glaciers weren't bulldozing all of that lovely swamp coating?
No, they weren't. The glaciers weren't bulldozing it, so it stood a chance of being preserved. But the last glacial maximum was a nasty, nasty time. You know, climate was very different. It was bleak. And it looks like Northland experienced some pretty dry conditions. We had fires up there as well. So preservation potential during the height of the last ice age, not good. We don't have anything between about 14,000 and again about 27,000. Nothing. No one has found any wood in that interval. And if they did, it would be world famous for science.
Thanks, Drew. And good luck finding those missing years. Andrew Laurie is a climate scientist at NIWA. I'll put a link to other interviews that he's done about the old weather records and the week that snowed, as well as his work with Kauri Tree Rings on the Our Changing World webpage, rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld. While you're there, why not sign up for our free weekly email newsletter? If you'd like to get in touch, we are on Twitter and Facebook as RNZ Science, or email us at ourchangingworld@rnz.co.nz. Many thanks for your company. I'm back at the same time next week, but for now, it's good night from me, Alison Balance, Paul Marier.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.